Welcome aboard the Battleship Retention. I am Scott Nye.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David, it's a
yes.
later than usual. You had a late day at the office. The bosses were on your back to crunch the numbers, you know, to bring in the quarterly report.
I know, and I have a big presentation tomorrow. That's if
thing.
That if you think, based on like movies and TV, I thought that like half of office work was like a big presentation.
Right.
Like it was like you had a book report or something do every week or something. I don't give any presentations. I would say I've maybe given one ever in my job.
Okay.
It's not the nature of my job to give presentations.
Right.
Yeah.
But then when you have one, it's really a big presentation.
I guess it would be. Yeah. Yeah. So I have a couple of things I wanted to point out. One that I think that is potentially very sad for you and me and people who love contemporary world cinema. You know, Argentina recently elected its own like right-wing nationalist populist.
It's Javier the hot Milei. New trend.
Yeah, and he is defunding the country's film and TV institute.
Oh wow, I didn't see that.
Yeah, so Argentina's been really hot lately in terms of art house and festival films.
Yeah,
and it's unclear to me. Maybe you know an Argentine listener could shed some light on what this means in the short term, but it does seem like, you know, state funded cinema has given us some of the best world cinema. And, it's something we don't do, almost any of at all here in the US. And, it's just, sad to see these nationalists who were often, you know, somewhat, especially in the US, like very isolationist. There's like the idea that of like cultural diplomacy doesn't mean anything to these right-wing nationalists, and that's very sad. And so I don't mean to be like sky is falling. I don't know if it directly is going to have a huge effect on what we see at film festivals and art houses in the next few years, but there's been just so much good stuff out of Argentina. We did a whole episode on it during the pandemic. I don't know. You have any thoughts on that?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it'll have a huge effect, and it'll be tough. It'll be interesting to see how that comes to bear. But yeah, that's a huge blow. I mean, especially at a time when the Argentinian economy is in such rough shape overall. So you can't imagine there's going to be much private sector eager to fund. I mean, especially like risky cinema, like La Flor, Trinquet Lacan, kind of stuff that we've really praised over the past couple of years from Argentina. That is too bad. And yeah, I mean, you can see it on the one hand with like the nationalist bend of like, well, we don't want to export this like artsy fartsy stuff. But you would think that they would keep it in line, just like export some super nationalist stuff or something. But sure. I guess really the ultimate bottom line on any kind of nationalist effort is just like to keep as much money at the top as possible and like right. not right. let any of it out for anything. So yeah, that is depressing.
And then the other thing I wanted to talk about that is not depressing, it actually kind of delights me.
Okay.
Now I've never seen the original Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze. I've seen the Jean Negrescu film starring Richard Widmark and Ida Lupino, that's called Roadhouse, but has nothing to do with it. I've never seen the 80s Roadhouse film. But
nor have I.
Okay. And nor have I seen the Jake Gyllenhaal one. But
yeah,
IMDb tells me that Patrick Swayze's character's name is James Dalton. Jake Gyllenhaal's character's name is not James Dalton. It is Dalton.
Oh.
But it is Elwood P. Dalton.
What?
Which, yes. which is as a big Jimmy Stewart fan and someone who has seen Harvey multiple times, I immediately recognized that that is a reference to Elwood P. Dowd, the character that Jimmy Stewart in Harvey. And so I was saying this to my wife. I was like, that's so weird. Like, why would they do this homage to this movie about a guy who can see an invisible 6-foot rabbit? And Natalie kind of like almost rolled her eyes at me. It was like, yeah, Donnie Darko. It's a reference to Donnie Darko, which then I also immediately realized is the movie that Jake Gyllenhaal and Patrick Swayze were both in.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So that's very clever and fun to name the character this weird roundabout reference to, you know, classic Hollywood, but also Jake Gyllenhaal's career and also the progeny of the character from its original actor. That's I just thought I was delighted by that.
Where do you even find this out? Because I'm looking at the film's Wikipedia page and its IMDb page, neither of which list his full name as Elwood P. Dalton.
Maybe I saw it on Twitter then. Yeah, no.
Information on Wiki and IMDb is always a little incomplete. I wouldn't be surprised if it is the case. I was just curious where you had heard it.
Oh, I just Googled Elwood P. Dalton, and definitely multiple reviewers have named the character, even though I don't know if anyone else has, at least in writing, made the Donnie Darko / Patrick Swayze connection.
I definitely would not have made the connection. I saw Harvey once many, many years ago, so I can't fault him too much, I guess.
Yeah, that's just, I wasn't someone who grew up on classic Hollywood. There were definitely some old musicals that I saw as a kid because my parents, my mom especially, really liked Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, so I definitely saw that. But there were a handful of comedies that my grandma liked and had VHS tapes of.
Oh, interesting.
And that I saw pretty young and have seen multiple times. The two that come to mind are Harvey and Arsenic and Old Lace. I know Arsenic and Old Lace is one of your lower tier Cary Grant films.
I'm honestly not that big on Harvey either, so it seems like your grandma and I are very at odds with our classic movie taste.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So when I saw that the character was named Elwood P. Dalton, I made the connection immediately. So anyway, that's very fun. I like that. Will I see the movie? I don't know. Are you going to watch it?
I mean, I was tempted to. The thing with me and Doug Liman is I'm always like interested in what he's doing, but I'm struggling to think of the last Doug Liman movie I actually went to go see or sat down and saw, as the case may be. Let's take a look here.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I saw Edge of Tomorrow in the theater.
Yeah, that was the last. Or no, I did see American Made, the other Tom Cruise movie he did.
Oh, that was after Edge of Tomorrow?
Yeah, it was 2017.
Wow, why did I think that was before? Yeah, I did not see that one. But
American Made's pretty cool. It's like, it's very, that was really the marking point where I was like, Tom Cruise is past a certain threshold where he's, and now apparently he's like doing a movie with Inarritu and he's like trying to go back to kind of like his auteurist roots, as it were. But when watching American Made, I was like, the Tom Cruise of 20 years ago would have made it, given a lot more interesting performance right than he's giving in 2017. Though it does have a scene where he performs a sex scene while actively flying an airplane, which is like, it's kind of an underrated Tom Cruise stunt. Like, there's kind of like, you know, the great annals of Tom Cruise stunts with Mission Impossible stuff in the past 10, 15 years. But performing a sex scene while the airplane is actively in the air, I got to give him kudos there.
Okay, I'm looking at his IMDb. I'm seeing all sorts of fun stuff that I didn't know. Well, I'd forgotten that he made the documentary about Brett Kavanaugh, Justice. Completely forgot that.
I didn't think I'd remember that happening.
I had to hit on Justice. It's like, I think this was, I don't know if it ever really came out. I think it was like a secret Sundance premiere. Yeah. Yes, I looked at release dates. The only place it has ever played is Sundance 2023, and it was like not announced until the day of or day before, I think.
Is it just awful. Like, that's so strange that like a political hot button documentary would not get any kind of like HBO Max debut or whatever.
Maybe Kavanaugh has like maybe it's tied up in legal things. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's see. I didn't see Chaos Walking. I heard mixed things, but that was one of those like sort of movies that got lost to the fog of the pandemic.
Yeah, I wanted to see it, but yeah, the pandemic fog did kind of brush that one under the table.
Edge of Tomorrow is the last one I've seen. I saw Jumper. I didn't like Jumper.
Didn't see Jumper.
I did not know, because there's a new Amazon Prime series of Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Donald Glover and what's her name from Pen 15?
I don't remember.
Is that her name? I didn't know that Doug Liman made a pilot for a Mr. and Mrs. Smith series that I guess didn't go, starring Martin Henderson and Jordana Brewster.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, he directed the Brad Pitt Angelina Jolie movie.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I didn't know there was this pilot. Jordana Brewster is an actress I've always liked, but I feel like she just does the Fast and the Furious movies, and then, like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like she does a whole lot else.
No, I for sure. I kind of have the same feeling of like, I feel like I like her, but why do I like her? Yeah. Do I just like her because she's pretty? That might be. That's a perfectly valid reason.
Yeah. But anyway, we're way off topic. That's okay. We have kind of a light topic today anyway, so we can
sure do
have fun with it. But first, before we go any further, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds. And they look great. They sound great. Tyler and I, tweakedaudio.com is where you go for fresh quality earbuds, a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great.
There you are.
Each and every day of my life. Today, I was using them to listen to a new, I guess you'd call it emo type band or a new album. But the band's called Golfer. The album's called Third Wind. It's to for whatever this means to you or me or anyone, it's best emo album of the year so far. But it is really good.
Go ahead. I did not know they were still making emo music in year 2024.
Emo is huge. Sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back, and we're ready to talk about this topic. Let's get into it, shall we? Scott, what are we talking about?
I forgot to like kind of coalesce this around a catchier title than just opposite of pet themes. But
you kind of in your text message, you kind of used the word turn off. So you could call it like turn offs.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's a good way to think of it. But just like my idea, maybe you approach this differently and that'll be great. But it's just like premises for movies or just like log lines that you hear or like kind of vibes you get from the trailers that are automatically like, crap. Some resistance towards seeing the movie, and maybe you end up seeing it because you feel some obligation because it's like in the conversation or it's a big award season play or whatever, and you end up having to go, or you skip it for that reason, or you see it and you like it, but you don't like it as much as so many other people because it kind of falls in this wheelhouse of types of movies you tend not to like. You and Tyler did an episode on pet themes years ago, and I thought it'd be interesting to explore the exact opposite of that, of things that you would rather not deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I took mostly the same tack as what you're describing, but there are also certain things, or at least one thing I thought of that isn't like, not necessarily something you would know going into the movie, but if something happens in the movie that I'm like, ugh,
oh,
I'm only going to be so invested. Well, okay, I'll just say that one first.
Yeah.
I despise the lazy thing of like the conflict between the two characters before they inevitably reconcile is because of a like misunderstood overhearing thing. Like, oh, I heard, like, you know, the there's like the Mighty Ducks where Emilio Estevez is talking to the other coach and like he's disparaging his players, but he's doing it sarcastically, but the players overhear him and don't get that, and there's a big like falling out. I hate that so much. It's just, it's so lazy, and it's also the kind of thing that it often requires the characters to not behave as characters ought to behave in that moment, which is like, hey, this person that I'm friends with or that I am close to in some way seems to have said something disparaging about me.
Right.
I guess I'll just shut them out of my life like a fucking sociopath, as opposed to like ask them about it.
I don't know. I mean, I feel two ways about it, because I do find it frustrating on a dramatic level where like it does feel like that's kind of like poorly motivated. There's a better way to go about it just from a construction standpoint. But I feel like that kind of thing happens a lot in life where like, I feel like it's even happens to me where like I'll hear something about somebody and won't necessarily confront them about it, but that will inform how I approach them in life.
Well, now I'm curious. I want to know if we can tell any stories about that.
I guess we do have some that would be commonalities.
What? Oh shoot, you cut out
here. But I'm thinking mostly from like a professional standpoint.
Okay,
but. I don't know. I feel like it comes from a certain human place that I do see a lot in life. And I think like to a degree, I don't know if this is heightened in LA or not, but I think there's an element of Los Angeles culture that's very like passive aggressive and like tends to assume rumors are true kind of thing.
I have one. It's a thing that's kind of like that, where there is a I'm not going to name names.
Yeah.
If this were the Patreon, maybe I would name names. But there is a film critic who has worked for many years. I've met him at festivals. I know people who know him. He's, I think, generally a well regarded film critic. And also, this is important, like politically very progressive, as am I. So he's on the same page.
Sure.
But 20 years ago,
oh my God,
he wrote a review of In the Cut in which he said something like, as if anyone wants to see Meg Ryan naked now that she's like 40 or whatever.
Right.
And I'm so mad at that all these years later, that I still like, even I can't remember what the movie was, but I sat next to him at a movie at Sundance and was like cordial and polite. But in the back of my head, I'm like, this motherfucker.
See, this is what I'm saying.
It's like, it's cruel to talk shit about Meg Ryan, and also In the Cut rules. Anyway.
So, this was the same. People don't, I don't think people are as confront. I mean, maybe I can't remember the situation in the Mighty Ducks, but I do feel like you're right that in the majority of the cases in when it's used in film, it is like people who are supposed to be close to each other.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the only one that I thought of that's like an in movie, like sudden switch to turn off type of thing. I'm sure there are other ones that I'm not thinking of. But I guess the first, my mind went to one place and then an immediate follow-up, which is that all of these are like with an asterisk, which is like, I can be not into a certain premise, but if enough people say the movie's good, if it's from a director I like, blah blah blah, it I'll watch it, and if it ends up being good, I'm not going to hold that against it. Case in point, I am, all things being equal, so bored of courtroom drama. It's one of my least favorite modes. And yet, the Caine Mutiny Court Martial was in my top 10 movies of 2023. And obviously, Anatomy of a Fall was amazing. Saint-Omer the year before was in my top 10. So, like, it's not really like it. It might be a bit of a turnoff, but it's not. It's something that can be overcome. And I will give the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. For each of the kind of the categories I came up with, I've found exceptions to the rule, as it were. And I didn't think of courtroom drama, but I have a similar kind of turnoff. And yeah, the past year and a half has really challenged my assertion that I tend not to like courtroom dramas, because I'm like, well, hell, maybe I do. Maybe they've just been bad for so long that I just forgot how much I loved it. Because, like, I love Anatomy of a Murder, too, to speak of another Anatomy courtroom drama. That's fantastic.
Yeah. But I guess I'm thinking of, when I think of courtroom drama, I'm thinking of, like, A Civil Action or A Time to Kill or movies.
Oh, totally. No, I mean, I'm generally with you. They are, by and large, not my favorite mode. And it's even worse. Yeah. So here's, like, an in-the-moment turnoff is, like, there'll be film noirs that'll be like normal movies for a long time, and then like in the last like quarter they'll turn into courtroom dramas, right? And I'm like, oh, shit, I was liking this movie.
Yeah. Oh, what was the movie, not that I was really into it, what was the movie a few years ago, Guy Pearce was in it, it was about like a painting.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, now I gotta look it up. I do remember what you're talking about.
That's another one that I was like, oh man, this is a courtroom drama. And it was a bummer. I mean, not that the movie was like great up until then, but
yeah, I mean, it's such like a convenient way to wrap things up, especially to be like, well, we got all these. Oh, is it The Last Vermeer?
That's right. Yes,
yeah, it's such a convenient way to be like, oh, we got all these plot threads. We can't really like do this dramatically. We just throw everyone in a room and make them ask each other questions.
Yeah. The Last Vermeer. There's so many movies with Vermeer in the title that are about Vermeer. There's The Last Vermeer.
I mean, you would hope so.
There's Tim's Vermeer. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No.
And then just this last year, there was Close to Vermeer, which was really a really good. The last two are both documentaries. But yeah, Close to Vermeer is just a documentary about setting up the biggest Vermeer retrospective at this museum, in going around the world and collecting all the Vermeer pieces. Really good documentary. Tim's Vermeer is a really fascinating documentary because it's about a guy. I don't know how much you know about Vermeer.
I know nothing about Vermeer.
Okay. Well, I mean, he painted light and shadow in a way that it was so far ahead of his time that there are people, I don't even know if this would be conspiracy theory or whatever, there are people who theorize that he was using essentially a kind of camera obscura and then almost like painting over what he could see, so he was like verisimilitudinally copying every different like shade or whatever.
And okay,
Tim's Vermeer is a documentary about a guy who basically tried to prove that point by painting a Vermeer, like restaging in a room, like literally he had like mannequins dressed up in the exact like clothes, and he took a picture at the exact right time of day, or like looked through the camera obscura at the exact right time of day for the shadow, and spent like months painstakingly recreating a Vermeer painting according to this method that some have guessed that Vermeer may have used to make his shading so meticulous, I guess. It's a fascinating documentary.
How'd it turn out?
It turns out perfect. Makes a copy, like it looks like a copy of the Vermeer. And, well done. And the whole like camera obscura, whatever you want to call it, thing comes up in Close to Vermeer too, where it is discussed and neither accepted nor dismissed, but just sort of discussed as a possibility. We're already so far off topic, we're talking about Johannes Vermeer, but I think there's a reason there's a lot of movies about Vermeer, because he was so focused on light and shadow, which is what, you know, movies are, I guess.
Sure.
That I think it makes sense that people who like photography and cinematography also like Vermeer. Okay.
Well, to go on a completely different tack, the first category I came up with in this like opposite pet themes thing is I came to the realization several years ago that I simply do not like specifically Godzilla, but generally giant monster movies. Do not care for them. Don't really see the appeal. I think it's just like something you had to attach yourself to as a child and carry with you into adulthood. I don't know. Do you care for the giant monster? No,
it is so funny you mentioned this because I went to a screening the other day, a screening of Immaculate, which I think, yeah, this episode's not correct. I can say is a disappointment. Immaculate.
Oh, that's too bad.
It's insanely derivative. It's basically just Rosemary's Baby if Rosemary were a nun. But not that interesting. I will say it really goes for it with the ending, with the like final 5 minutes, and to the point where I was like, that might have been worth it. It has a great ending in Sydney Sweeney, an ending that really depends on Sydney Sweeney giving her all, and she does a great job. Anyway, that's not the point. The point was, before the movie started, I was set between two critics. One I know, Jeff Ewing, shout out Jeff Ewing, good guy, used to write for Slash Film before they like laid everybody off. Now he's freelance. And then another critic that I only met that night, whose name I've already forgotten. I'm sorry. And they're both, Jeff actually hosts a podcast called Humanoids the Deep Dive that is specifically a podcast about monster movies. So he's a huge monster movie guy.
Yeah.
So these two guys, I'm in between these two guys who love monster movies. And of course the topic gets to Godzilla. And like, they look at me at one point, like for me to weigh in. And I was like, you guys might as well be speaking a foreign language. Like,
yeah.
I don't know shit about Godzilla. And I realized that I've seen Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, and I've seen the Raymond Burr featured cut of like the American cut of the like original Godzilla, which I saw when I was very young. Because I think like this was back when I was renting VHS at a video store, and that was just like, literally all the video store had was that cut. So I watched that, and that's all I've seen of Godzilla. And so yeah, Jeff said he was going to put together like a primer for me to like, here's the movies you need to watch. But I was also like, you know, there's like some Truffaut movies I haven't seen.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I'm going to do that. But yeah, I don't know if it's so much that it's a turnoff, but it is, I guess this is, there's a difference between like movies that are a turnoff and then movies like your Red Notices and your Gray Man movie that are just like complete disinterest.
Oh, sure. And, maybe fall somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's more that I'm not, but I guess I'll ask you, how big does the monster have to get before you're not interested? Like, do you like the host?
Yeah, so this was a question I have asked myself many times over the years as I've considered exactly this topic. Because, yeah, I've seen more of the giant monster movies than you. I've seen the original Godzilla plus the Raymond Burr version. I've seen the Roland Emmerich Godzilla. I've seen the 2014 Godzilla. I've seen King Kong Skull Island. So that, like, that and Kong Skull Island ended up being like the revelatory thing to me, because I love the original King Kong. I love Peter Jackson's King Kong. But Kong Skull Island did nothing for me because they made King Kong so much bigger so that he could be the same size as Godzilla when they eventually team up. And so I think like King Kong size is like where I top out as far as monster size goes. And I don't know how tall canonically King Kong is supposed to be in those movies. But let's say maybe a three-story monster.
Okay. So do you like the host?
I do like the host, for sure. Yeah.
I like the host a lot.
But even like, that Anne Hathaway movie, Colossal, which I think is one of Anne Hathaway's best performances. I just didn't care for the movie.
I like the movie, but not because of the monster stuff.
Yeah.
Did you ever see the 70s King Kong?
No, I want to. I will someday, but I have not yet.
Well, yeah, when you return the two Blu-rays of mine you have, because that's your limit, I can lend you the 70s King Kong Blu-ray if you want.
Very fair.
Yeah, it's a decent movie, and it's also like, I feel like watching it, it's Jessica Lange's first role, and she's to be Purient, she's a total fucking sex kitten in this movie.
Sure.
And it's like, I feel like I get Jessica Lange in a way that I never did. Well, not that I ever disliked her, but it's like there's a whole new shading to her for me now that now colors her later work.
Now that you know she was hot once.
I mean, I knew she was. I guess this is weirdly, I was just thinking about this. Okay. That like, I feel like there's a saying that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I'm not sure that I'm going to push back against that a little bit.
Okay.
Because I feel like beauty is a little bit more objective because there are beauty standards, I guess.
Sure.
But hotness is completely subjective.
It's interesting.
It's about what you're into.
Right. Yeah.
And I guess I had this, we're going to be another like podcast of like dudes talking about Sydney Sweeney as an object. I'm sorry about that.
That's hey, she's in the news for exactly that reason these days.
But yeah, I guess that's why I was thinking like, I went into Immaculate because I've never seen, I know she like technically is in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Under the Silver Lake, but I don't really remember her in those movies. So I was pretty much a Sydney Sweeney virgin going into Immaculate. And I realized that like it's pretty much undeniable that she's beautiful, but as to whether or not she's hot, I think it's going to depend on what you're into. And I don't think Sydney Sweeney's my type. She's also too young for me, which could be a segue into another topic here. I don't know. What do you think of my theory about hotness is in the eye of the beholder?
Well, I think whenever whoever coined the term beauty is in the eye of the beholder did not have the term hotness at the ready in order to quickly substitute.
Comeliness?
Comeliness is in the eye of the beholder. Yeah, they should have come around with that. I wonder where that phrase came from.
Yeah.
Shakespeare times, let's say.
Probably.
I think your theory is generally true, but and maybe Sydney Sweeney is like the perfect example of this, given the fact that like so many people seem like intent on debating this for some God knows why reason. without getting into specifics, I think I agree with your premise. Especially because I find, generally speaking, that I have slightly unusual taste in women and sometimes find women extremely attractive who aren't like, you know, exactly Maxim cover girls. And I'm not sure why that is. And I'm not sure why everyone's so slow to pick up on that, or not pick up on my taste, but pick up on like these women being really attractive. And not to like pat myself on the back or anything. It's not, don't really care about that. It's just that I do see the difference in taste shapes society. And yeah, sometimes there will be those kind of like Maxim cover girls that I'm like, yeah, you know, as my old roommate Ben would say, wouldn't kick her out of bed for eating crackers, but yeah. You know.
Yeah. I mean, every once in a while, generally my tastes are not like the, magazine cover girls, but every once in a while, you know, you get a Trisha Helfer on Battlestar Galactica and it's like, yeah, that does it for me.
Oh, for sure. I'm still in the 18 to 40 demographic. I'm still susceptible to what the ad execs expect what my taste would be.
Okay. This is getting gross.
Perfect. My exception there though, is I loved Godzilla Minus One. Much to my surprise, okay. I kind of had written off any Godzilla movie, and then this one got so much praise that I was like, fine, I'll go see it. And sure enough, it's great.
Okay, so to go back, I was talking about how Sydney Sweeney is considerably younger than I am. And that brings me to another one that I know you don't really agree with me on, but age gaps. And I'm going to fully cop to the double standard, specifically older man, younger woman age gaps are a bit of a turnoff for me, as I've said before. You know, I'm a big fan of Mia Hansen-Levy, but Maya, it was hard for me to to get into it, because even though the movie's not like, Maya is clearly not like pro like this guy dating his dad's friend's daughter. Is that what it is?
I can't remember.
Yeah, who's still in college, and this guy's like divorced and in his 30s or whatever. The movie's not pro that, but it's still something that I'm like, just grow up. it's a hurdle for me.
Yeah, I was trying to remember, and I was trying to look this up now, but no one seems to account for it. For some reason, I thought in Maya she is under 18, but I could be misremembering that. And so I was going to ask you then if there's, like, where the line in the sand develops. Because, like, if your objection to Maya specifically, if I'm correct in remembering this, was, like, the fact that it's, you know, at least in America, illegal relationship. If that's the line, or if it's just, like, any 20-something with anyone over then what age?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's just a vibe. But like I said, it is very specific to older male, younger woman, hetero relationships, because right. I was not turned off by Call Me By Your Name. I was not turned off by Licorice Pizza. It's a very specific thing, because the double standard, these standards and imbalances of power already exist. So, and it's not that, yeah, these can be good movies. Maybe there's a sense of like, do we really have, is there more to say about this?
Well, I think I not to put words in your mouth, but my guess is your problem might be that there's a lack of acknowledgement in it that is just kind of like passively accepted.
Maybe. Yeah.
Because like it's not at all a hurdle for me, even when I like think it's kind of ridiculous. Because I mean, generally, my rule of thumb is like, hey, if there's heat, there's heat, and if they're communicating a sort of sexy vibe, then I can get on with anything. But like, Bridges of Madison County, a movie I love, where Meryl Streep, who's not, you know, by that point a young woman, she would have been, let's see, about 55, 56, but it is meant to be romancing Clint Eastwood, who's checking now, nearly 20 years older than her. And Clint Eastwood by the mid 90s is looking real old. And so I just like, I even in a movie that I love like that, I found their love scenes very hard to buy on just like a physical level of like, Meryl Streep, you can't be enjoying this. This seems actively unpleasant. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's definitely not like any kind of deal breaker for me. I can still like very much attach myself to those movies, though I do notice that those kind of things.
The example that I brought up before that actually got me subtweeted by someone I happen to follow and saw them subtweeting me when I mentioned the podcast. In Hail Caesar, Josh Brolin is married to Alison Pill.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, I guess because in my daily life, I don't know people who have those kind of age gap relationships. So it really does, like, when I see that, I'm not even disapproving. Alison Pill's a grown woman. And so is her character, who is her same age. That's fine. But it does make me wonder, like, how'd this come about?
I mean, there's an instance where you really could understand why, because like in the 50s and earlier, tons of young women would marry older guys for like financial stability and just like make a go of it. And that would be their life. And like, this was.
Yeah. I think about my grandpa was on my mom's side was 11 years older than my grandma.
Yeah, totally. It was, you know, not an uncommon thing. And like, if anything, 11 is fairly on the narrow side for the kind of age gap, you know. I think my grandparents had about the same gap, maybe more like 8 years. But yeah, I mean, because there was an expectation that men would establish themselves in a career before going out and getting married, the age then would be a more negotiable kind of premise for the relationship.
There was also, I mean, with my grandma and grandpa specifically, there was the whole thing of like, for a few years there, all of the men, or at least a lot of the men, were off at war.
Yeah, 100%.
Which is that was the case with my grandpa. I came back from the Philippines. No, it's been a long time. I can't remember where he was stationed, but somewhere in the Pacific theater. Anyway,
yeah.
I had another example that I was going to give, and now I've forgotten what it was. Damn, I had a good turn off, and now I can't remember what it was. Hopefully it'll come back to me.
Well, I got another one slightly related insofar as it's relationship family-based, is I just don't really care for movies about groups of children. I'm okay with movies about, like, single kids who are off on their own kind of adventure, but whenever there get to be, like, three or more of them, I'm like, I'm just past this. I grew up. I don't really care to think about childhood again. I don't really have anything I think to look back on. And I generally find that it's used to like simplify more complex adult topics. So like some examples of some fairly beloved movies that I just cannot get on with because I just don't care is like, well, last year's Totem was a big one for me that like I watched it and like, It was like this very interesting family drama that was all seen through the eyes of a 7-year-old, and it was all just so simplified to her eyes that I was like, I want to see well, the actual shit that's actually going on here. And like, I even have this problem with like E.T. I've never gotten on with E.T. because it's about a bunch of kids.
E.T. is overrated. I'm going to say it. I don't know if I've said it in the podcast before, but I rewatched it not recently, like probably pre-COVID, but I, as an adult, I rewatched it and I was like, oh, this should be tossed into the lower tier of Spielberg movies along with, I don't know, Hook. But then I don't know, maybe Hook's great. I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but I know a lot of people don't.
I doubt it.
But
it's also about groups of kids. but even like E.T. even had me going until the like third act when all of a sudden these kids on freaking like mountain bikes take down the government. I'm like, the premise has been stretched far too thin by this point.
How do you feel about Stand By Me?
I've never seen Stand By Me for exactly this reason, and I know I will someday just like really confront my premise here of how far I can push this, but so far it remains a turnoff.
I can't remember if I've made my Stand By Me joke on the podcast before.
Yeah, might as well.
I think. But it requires, do you know the premise of Stand By Me? Do you know what?
Just like where they find the body?
Yeah. Okay. So Stephen King called it The Body. Rob right. Reiner called it Stand By Me. Neither one of them thought to call it Remains to Be Seen.
It's pretty good.
Okay. I've probably said that in the podcast before, though.
Yeah. And then to name a franchise that will come up in multiple categories for me, this is one of many reasons why I do not care about the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah, although I remember from our marathon that when you rewatched Half-Blood Prince, you were into it.
Now I've already forgotten the titles. Is that the first seventh movie?
No, that's the sixth one. It's the one before the two seventh movies.
I have not seen Half-Blood Prince since it came out. I remember that getting more. No, it's very true. Because I did the commentary on Deathly Hallows Part One.
Oh, okay. Then maybe I'm misremembering. I, you know, those days tend to like blur together. So yeah, I thought you were really into Half Blood Prince, but I guess you're really into Deathly Hallows Part One.
Deathly Hallows Part One is by far the best of the Harry Potter movies to a considerable degree. I remember getting more on board with them starting with Half Blood Prince. And maybe it's just because the kids were finally grown up and it's like, okay, now we're dealing with real people. Now I care.
I liked Order of the Phoenix, but I think that was also, I was a big fan of the books,
right.
And Order of the Phoenix was my favorite of the books. So I think I liked that about it because I think what Order of the Phoenix has in common with Deathly Hallows Part One is that those are the two least plot driven of the movies. Like Order of the Phoenix is mostly like just Harry like being really fucking angry. and that's what I like about it. Anyway, but now we're millennials talking about Harry Potter, which is the most boring thing in the world.
Oh
yeah, that's another turn off. This wasn't what I was thinking, but like I am turned off by nostalgia to a point where it's like it might be to a fault that I am so
I've got that on my list.
Yeah. So that's why I have no interest in like the new Ghostbusters movies.
No.
Or like I never watched Stranger Things, speaking of kids on bicycles and stuff. I don't care about all that. Just like grow up, live in the present. That stuff drives me crazy. I have no interest in it. And it's the same with with Ghostbusters. But anytime you go back to a well, you know.
Oh yeah.
But this is where I say to a fault. I saw upon their first release, I saw all the Hunger Games movies. I liked three of them. Didn't like the last one, but then when they did this prequel, I was and Natalie, who was a fan, Natalie and I had seen all of the Hunger Games together. We saw all four of them at the Vista. Every time they come out, it became like a tradition for us to go to the Vista and then go to El Chavo afterwards. RIP.
Nice.
El Chavo got torn down years ago, but it hung around long enough for us to see all the movies. So then, when Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, was coming out, Natalie was like, "Do you want to go see it?" And I was like, "No, I don't." And then I felt bad for being like holier than thou. So I felt bad for that. And then people started seeing it, saying it was good, and I still haven't seen it. So my distaste for like hauling up the corpses of dead franchises and reanimating them cost me the chance to see a good movie in a theater with my wife.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird that you bring up that, because that to me doesn't even like register as nostalgic, as it's so soon after the kind of quote unquote original franchise. It's like, it's just like they took an extended break.
I was lumping two things together, which is just nostalgia, but I guess I was like seeing Ghostbusters, and it's just generally like, once a franchise is done, let it be done. Make another one. Make a different franchise, you know?
No, I am with you there. I mean, especially around the franchise stuff, which like, I'll see or not see kind of depending on who's involved. It does not have anything to do with the franchise itself. So like, I wouldn't have cared about Blade Runner 2049 if not for Denis Villeneuve being involved, which films I've been hit or miss on, but who I'm generally kind of interested in. And similarly, like when Ridley Scott went back to the Alien franchise, I didn't so much care that he had made the first Alien. I just like was in the habit of seeing Ridley Scott movies by that point.
Okay, I have things to say before I lose.
Yeah.
Another example, going back to the Harry Potter book, sorry, I said it was gonna be done, but I read the books multiple times, and then when that like play, The Cursed Child, came out and was published, I was like, I'm done. I don't need it. I don't need to watch that. I liked the thing. I've moved on. The other thing, off topic, but you mentioned Blade Runner 2049, and you and I and Julie all happened to recently see One from the Heart reprise in the theater. So when I saw Blade Runner 2049, I got the, like, what is it, Alphaville reference? The full-size guy standing in the corner of the frame, and then like woman's face. Like, I was, when I saw that, when that happens in 2049 with Ana de Armas, right?
Yep.
I thought of Alphaville, but I forgot that Francis Ford Coppola had also done the exact same thing in One from the Heart with Frederick Forrest and Natasha Kinski. Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was cool. So I don't know who was Denis Villeneuve referencing Godard, or was he referencing Coppola? I don't know.
Well, he's a French speaking Canadian. I'm going to default to think he's probably going for Godard.
Okay. All right.
My nostalgia objection even extends further than that. Like, not only against like franchise, but against like kind of like slice of life past movies that are set in the past for seemingly no other reason than just like the filmmaker has an affection for the period. So this was an active problem for me with The Holdovers, which like from moment one I was like kind of geared against, because it was so actively trying to be a Hal Ashby movie that I was like, come on, man, do your own thing. But like, this is a big reason why I frequently like demanded nobody, it's not like they can hear me, but demanded that Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson make some movie in the present at some point, because it's like, it's getting old, guys. We know you love the 60s and 70s or whatever, but it doesn't really feel like their movies are motivated by anything other than just their affection for the aesthetics of that time period.
But I guess I'll push back against that just as a devil's advocate thing. Because I recently saw a movie that I guess technically came out, but it came and went just earlier this month or last month, called Snack Shack. Have you heard of Snack Shack?
I have.
And that's set in 1991, summer of 1991. But I think if you're telling a coming of age story, often I'm assuming the writer is projecting their own personality onto it. And so wouldn't the period piece just be like a write what you know, like it fits type of thing?
I mean, so I agree and I disagree. So like my exception to this is one where I agree with your point, which my exception is Dazed and Confused, which like Richard Linklater like graduated the year that that film takes place or whatever. And he has an active recall and nostalgia for that time period that I think comes through in that movie. But like Licorice Pizza takes place like when Paul Thomas Anderson was like 3 years old. Dude doesn't have any nostalgia for 1972 or whatever. He didn't exist. He wasn't a person with any consciousness. He just has an affection for that period. If he wanted to really be nostalgic for that period in his life, he'd set it in like 1987 or whatever, but that wouldn't be as like hip and cool and like wouldn't speak to these like things that he likes about a period he just missed out on, which like I can relate to that. There are things that I kind of like look back on like the early 90s of when I would have been like the similar age and have a certain degree of nostalgia for. But when you start to build a whole movie around that, I start feel like it starts to wear thin. And definitely the same goes with Wes Anderson, who like keeps setting movies in like the 50s and 60s, but man was not alive then.
Right. Yeah. By the way, I'm looking, Snack Shack still in theaters, and I would say worth
seeing. Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I've been seeing now that it stars Gabriel LaBelle, who of course post Fablemans, big fan of.
Yeah, but this is now. Okay, this could get us back on the topic. Suspension of disbelief. Peter Gabriel's character in the movie, sorry, Peter Gabriel. Gabriel LaBelle's character in the movie is supposed to be 14 years old.
Oh, no.
But Gabriel LaBelle is like 21 or something.
Yeah, and like, he has a kind of childish look that like you pass off for Fableman, but 14 now.
But I would say like the movie, by having all three of like the two main boys are supposed to be 14 and the main girl is supposed to be 16. They're all played by actors in the young 20s. So the consistency of it helped me suspend my disbelief.
Fair enough.
I do think it's a movie that's worth checking out. I mean, it's not like reinventing anything, but it's a solid, like coming of age, somewhat raunchy love triangle comedy, not that raunchy, but R rated. Anyway, sure. I liked it. But yeah, suspension of disbelief, I think, is another thing that is like, it's going to be subjective. Some people can suspend disbelief more than others, you know. At TIFF this past year, I saw the new, I don't know how you say it, Azazel Jacobs movie.
Oh, yeah.
Called His Three Daughters, which is great.
I know, I can't wait to see it.
Carrie Coon, Elizabeth Olsen, and Natasha Lyonne play sisters. Now, I will say it is revealed fairly early on that Natasha Lyonne is not a blood relation. They're sisters, okay. But she's the daughter of Tracy Letts plays their father, and she's the daughter of his second wife, whom he adopted. But still. I remember telling Natalie about the movie, and this is more of a hang up for her when siblings in movies don't look like they could be siblings. She always notices it. So even like Carrie Coon and Elizabeth Olsen, she's like, I don't know that I buy that they're from the same brood, but that's not for me. That's not a hang up. I would say, I don't know. This is just a one specific example. I can't think of a lot of movies that have done this because this is just specific conceit. But like any good modern day cinephile, I like Christian Petzold's movies, but I could never get on board with Phoenix because I just couldn't buy that the guy doesn't recognize his wife. I know she's had plastic surgery, but if you're spending, this is someone you were married to, and then you meet her again, if you're spending any amount of time with her, you're going to recognize her. Even if her face looks different, She's still the same person, right? Anyway, I had so much difficulty with that element of Phoenix that I don't think I was ever able to fully let the movie do what it wanted to do.
Yeah, I don't remember Phoenix specifically enough to try to defend it. I feel like I remember there being an element of like him actively like being in self-denial, but I know that the ending hinges on his realization too, so it's tough for me to say.
Yeah, now that you say that, I think that was your defense at the time when I brought this up.
Hey, perfect. Then I stand by it. Suspension of disbelief is, to me, it's always like an emotional thing of like, are the people on screen selling it or not? And you can kind of feel that or not. So like I was watching, I haven't finished it yet, but I was watching The Core, the 2003 disaster movie about the Earth's core stops spinning. And it's like one-to-one playing the Armageddon playbook of like from the casting down to the story beats. It's like precisely mapped on Armageddon. And I've seen Armageddon so many times, and I love Armageddon. And Armageddon can get away with its ridiculous science stuff because it's so like relentlessly visceral. And acting is so like passionate. It's like it's really like putting you into the moment of everything they're going through. So you're like, yeah, fire and space, who cares? But like The Core, I mean, again, I haven't finished it yet, but so far, like, it's so dully told and so like impassionate about the beats that it's going through that whenever their like survival is relying on some ridiculous science thing, I'm like, come on, guys, this can't happen. So like if the filmmakers and the actors are selling it, then it goes a long way.
Does The Core for you, and I haven't seen it since it was like,
yeah,
like first on DVD, I think, does it rise to the level of your definition of camp at any point?
It's right around there right now so far. I'll have to see how it kind of finishes off, but yeah, it's hanging in there.
The main thing I remember from The Core is, and I think it's right at the beginning, Aaron Eckhart like lighting a tennis ball on fire to illustrate what it would look like if the world were on fire.
Yeah, his whole demonstration of how this is all going to go down is real thin and no real visceral energy. Nobody really seems convinced that the world's going to end. Right. So far, the most passionate, and I kind of appreciate this actually, the most passionate anyone's been has been when Stanley Tucci realizes that his life is in danger as a result of this mission and is only concerned about his survival and getting back to publish his books. And I kind of appreciate how much energy Stanley Tucci was putting in that moment.
We've been going for a while. I feel like I had others that I'm like now losing out on.
I have a lot more, so we can either keep going or we can save this for maybe a part two someday, whatever you like.
No, let's keep going. But I'll throw it mostly to you, though. I did think of another one. A turnoff for me is any movie that like, I guess it's kind of like I don't want to belong to a club that would have a member like me, sure, or whatever. Like movies that are so panderingly in my like political wheelhouse.
Oh yeah.
That's like Boy Erased was one that I was like, I think that the term the critics often use is that it's like flattering the audience. By saying like, aren't you a good person for acknowledging that like conversion therapy is vile?
And like right around the same time, right around the same time, Ben is Back, the movie that was that another conversion? Oh no, it's just also Lucas Hedges in it. That's all I'm thinking of.
But there was Beautiful Boy.
Yeah. Oh god.
Which is different because that was about drug addiction, but also quite bad.
Yeah, Ben is Back is also about drug addiction. I'm confusing all three of those movies.
But the thing is, Ben is Back is good.
Ben is Back is good, largely because of Julia Roberts.
But also because it's an issue movie that's about drug addiction or whatever, but it turns into like a thriller mystery, right? Because like,
yeah,
he comes back for Thanksgiving. He's in rehab, but he gets like a weekend pass to spend Thanksgiving or something. And then, like, his old drug dealer that he owes money to, like, steals his dog or something.
Yeah, something like
that. And so the movie is just, like, mostly Lucas Hedges and Julia Roberts, like, sort of looking for this dog. But in order to do so, they have to, like, confront like his past and the stuff that he's like trying to
right.
run away from. I think by turning it into kind of a genre movie with this like thriller mystery hook, is that's what made it work so well for me. And yeah, great performances. But that was one like Natalie, and I get this, if we watch a movie and we watch it at home, Natalie wants to sit with it for a few minutes before we start talking about it. But I went into Ben Is Back expecting it to be like Beautiful Boy or whatever.
Yeah.
And like the fact that it was good, as soon as the credits were rolling, I turned to her and I was like, that was good, huh? And she was like, she was like, yeah, let me think about it. But I was like, I was so happy that it was good.
The Miseducation Cameron Post, that's the other like conversion therapy drama that I was thinking of from that time.
I did not see that one. But
not,
yeah, there
not
are lots
good.
Of, there's a lot of like documentaries, like,
oh god, yeah.
American Factory was one that I watched because it got a lot of awards attention that year that it came. I think it even got nominated for an Oscar, right? It might have even won.
I'm pretty sure at least got nominated. Yeah, I'm not sure about. Yeah. I can't remember.
Does Barack Obama have an Oscar? yeah, and that was one that was like, yeah, this is a movie about labor unions that I'm for, and it's, I don't know, it's not anything new to me.
Yeah,
I avoided the year that I guess it was 2019, Sundance 2019. I didn't go see Knock Down the House, the documentary, because yeah. It was being clearly being pushed as like, it's a documentary about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, we'll get to call her from now on. And I was like, yeah, I know I like her. I don't need this hagiography. And then it wasn't until I went to a press screening right before it came out that I realized that that's only part of it, that it's actually a documentary about four different political campaigns. And this is the opposite of a turnoff. Political campaign documentaries, that is
sure.
Fodder. That is fodder for me. I love that stuff. I eat that stuff up with a spoon. And so I ended up really liking Knock Down the House. But I missed my first chance to see it because I was sure it was something that it wasn't, that I don't like.
So kind of relatedly to like the movies that are on our side politically discussion, but, and this is one that I think you and I disagree on in terms of like, turn offs or turn ons, but I really have a hard time getting excited about any sci-fi satire or cultural commentary, at this point in time.
Sci-fi satire?
Specifically a movie that's trying to satire some element of society or make a comment on some element of society through a science fiction premise that's like, what if love didn't exist?
I'm trying to think of an example. Are you talking about like The Invention of Lying? Or
yeah, so The Invention of Lying. I have so many examples. So you got The Invention of Lying. You got a terrible movie that nobody saw, but I saw it because it starred Kirsten Dunst, called Upside Down, which was about gravity being inverted on two different places and two people trying to reconnect despite this. I know we both don't like Don't Look Up, of course. Everyone dislikes that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a big reason why I don't like The Hunger Games. I know you are more favorable towards that franchise. But also like District 9, I couldn't stand because it was just like, what if apartheid had aliens, man? You ever think about that? Or this was also why I couldn't stand Sorry to Bother You, because it's like, what if things were even worse in capitalism and they turned you into a horse? It's like, sure, why not? And like, I most probably inflammatorily, as far as the listeners are concerned, or and maybe even you, but I recently, in the past couple of years, finally saw Starship Troopers, and I just did not care because I was like, wow. It's come up recently because people are like once again shocked that people are missing out on the satirical point of it, which like I am also shocked by that because it was so glaringly obvious that it was so dull to watch to me. Of like, what
I was
going to
say? Yeah, I don't know. I remember how old you were when it came out, but it was like shocking how few people got what was going on in Starship Troopers.
Yeah. And finally seeing the movie, I cannot believe that. I mean, you know, new release movie, it falls into a certain sphere, and critics like are just trying to make their deadline. Sure, I can see how maybe the week of release you miss out on it, but it, you know, almost 30 years later, you're just watching on Saturday afternoon. It's inconceivable to me that this is still being bandied about and discussed as an active topic, because the film is so glaringly obvious that it is completely wasted to me.
I feel like with some of those, though, you're like kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater in a way, because like, yeah, Sorry to Bother You isn't exactly revelatory in terms of its themes, but it's also a very fun, funny movie. So like, can't you enjoy it for that?
I guess I could if the comedy didn't feel like it was constantly trying to drive home this point. I guess to use an example that I know you don't like, but I kind of do, Idiocracy is like, the satirical element of that is like a complete nothing, but I find the jokes so dumbly endearing that I kind of like the movie.
All right, maybe I should watch that one again. It's been a very long time.
I find it so useful as a reference point too, to just be like, it's got electrolytes, or, you know, Ass the Movie or whatever. It's like, it gets down to the very element of it so much that it's not trying to be, maybe that's my problem. It's like, some of these movies are trying to be smart about like the thing that they're tackling. Idiocracy is trying to be dumb about the thing it's tackling, and I kind of dig that about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I thought of another turnoff though, since we're talking about comedy, sort of post Marvel Deadpool David Leitch like quippiness that isn't actually jokes.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, like, movies that are trying to be funny and then aren't are the toughest sits.
100%.
And yeah, Bullet Train was a painful movie for me to sit through. I'll say this. Oh man, I'll say the same about the Netflix movie Nimona, which I think got nominated for best animated
movie. It sure did.
It's terrible, and it's terribly unfunny. And also, I'm gonna join the chorus of people who like decry the sort of major like corporate movies having like a gay element,
and
trying to pretend like they're like smashing boundaries or whatever. Like, yeah, the main guy in the movie is gay, and we see him at the beginning hold a guy's hand, and at the end they kiss. And that is it. And yet Netflix would have you believe that this is like so bold,
right?
By having that it's knocking down walls by having a gay character. Sorry, I said I was gonna let you run with the rest of the episode, but I keep thinking of things.
No, that's what we're here for. Yeah, well, now I'm glad I skipped on Nimona. It's weird that you say that they were like foregrounding that, because I didn't hear about that element at all.
Oh really?
Yeah.
That's funny, because yeah, I guess because I went to an FYC screening of the movie at Netflix, so like the poster that they had up outside the screening room was like highlighting,
oh sure,
pull quotes from reviews that were like unabashedly queer or whatever.
But maybe slightly abashedly.
Yeah.
I guess somewhat related to that, I couldn't say for sure whether or not that film falls in this category, but it made me think of it anyway, is like movies where the protagonist is like the specialist boy, or more so boy, but like sometimes girl, but specialist boy in the world movies.
Okay.
Like Perks of Being a Wallflower, or well, we mentioned Beautiful Boy, definitely The Way, Way Back, definitely Charlie Bartlett, definitely Jojo Rabbit, and like the Harry Potter movies. Again, like there's several things about the Harry Potter movies that drive me crazy, where like the protagonist is like the most precious child and needs to be protected at all costs. And I not only find that dramatically inert, but I think it's probably damaged a generation of children.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of the movies you mentioned, but The Way, Way Back and Jojo Rabbit are movies that I like. I can taste blood in my mouth. I hate those movies so much.
Yeah, they are rough sledding. The exception to which, though, is Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous, which I love, but it's definitely about how special Cameron Crowe is.
Yeah, that's another one that I think I was going to do back when I used to have time to write. I was going to do a series of like revisiting movies that I didn't like when they came out, but that are well thought of, and seeing like, have I changed? Was I wrong? And yeah, Almost Famous is one of them. I didn't care for it that much when it came out. I think a lot of for a lot of those reasons. Also, the main reason I think that I don't like or didn't vibe with Almost Famous is that it's so proud of its main character being uncool. It has the whole Philip Seymour Hoffman
right.
speech about being uncool, and I say, fuck that. I'm cool. I don't know what it's like to be uncool. I'm cool, and you can be cool too if you want. Like, the sad sacks. Oh, yeah, that's another turnoff. Yeah, sad sack men, or like, not sad sack men, as much as like the dude who is like, pining in silence for a girl, like the sort of like pretty in pink ducky
sure.
thing. You know, I know so many people who are like, you know, alt kids like me who are like, oh, she should end up with Ducky. And I'm like, fuck Ducky. He'll get the girl when he gets a fucking spine.
Yeah. I think I'm largely with you there. I guess, how does that extend, or how do you see that in relation to like a movie that I know you like, which is like Past Lives?
Well, I mean, that's different. That's not like, I mean, they were separated when they were kids, and he's not like holding back his feelings because he's too shy or anything. It's like she's married, and he knows that, and that's why it's like that's bittersweet, where like everything is on the table, you know, as opposed to like, yeah, Ducky being like, it's been a while since I've seen Pretty in Pink, but at one point, like, his buddy or someone is like, you just got to tell her how you feel. And it's like, bro, she knows how you feel. She just doesn't like you. So I think Past Lives is a different dynamic.
Okay, fair enough. Let me see here. Oh, yeah, the other one I wanted to mention for sure was like, anything that has to do with like family legacy or like parental things, like having an active effect on someone as an adult. I don't mean like someone's getting over trauma or something like that, but what really drives me crazy in movies is when like someone goes back to the old neighborhood and they're like, you know, that's Jimmy Doherty's kid. And they're like, what the fuck is he doing here? And like, who gives a shit?
There are definitely communities where, though, in this country, where people would give a shit about that.
I know. I it's just so far from my own experience, maybe. Right. And like, yeah. I can't like glom onto it in any way, that it just bounces right off of me.
Yeah. But I mean, you just hit on a whole subgenre that's like, yeah, sad single man returns to his hometown thing. Like, it's all kind of like The Graduate's a good movie, but it doesn't mean that I enjoyed sitting through Garden State or sure. The Hollers. If anyone remembers,
I missed out on The Hollers. Yeah,
yeah. Oof. Yeah, that's a whole subgenre unto itself of like these losers.
I think I like the like coming back home movie to an extent, if it's less like coming from like an attack in the character's way. Like, I guess my big problem is when the town that they're coming back to has some problem with their family that then gets taken out in the characters. If the character is just like down about their life in general, that's something I can like relate to and get along with, because it's like, it's a more interior experience. But when everyone's like letting somebody who had nothing to do with this kid affect their perception of them, I'm like, yeah, who cares about these assholes? Like, don't worry about impressing them. And like, I definitely think that like Garden State kind of fell in this trap, but like, I like a movie when somebody comes back to a town when they've already had some of their own life experience. I think this is part of the reason why The Graduate kind of bounces off of me, is like, the kid's just gone to college or whatever. Like, everyone comes back to home after, or not everyone, but like a lot of people go back home after college and like are kind of lost or whatever. That's not like that unique or strange an experience that like requires some investigation. That's just kind of a normal course of life, or I would say at this point, the majority of adults. But weirdly, like Elizabethtown works a lot better for me, because it's like about this guy who thought he had his life established and then goes back home when he finds he doesn't.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah.
All right, what else you got?
Let's see. I guess I'll throw out real quick. I mentioned this in the podcast before. I just never have much more investigation other than I just don't really care about films about royalty, especially male royalty. Like I like a Marie Antoinette that's like detailing how women kind of survive this weird hierarchy of power. But when it's just like men negotiating for power, I check out. I don't care.
Yeah, you and I are on very different pages.
I know.
There, yeah. I love sort of like anything about like medieval politics. I love Mary Queen of Scots. That was so cool. I like that kind of stuff. I also like, this is another one where Natalie and I often don't see eye to eye. I like movies about rich people.
I generally do too. And
yeah,
for some reason it stops at royalty. It's like, so like I really liked Napoleon from this past year because it's about royalty, but it's about a guy who seized the royalty on his own. He wasn't like born into it or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, I do generally like movies about rich people because it's like, once you remove all the kind of like bullshit that the rest of us have to negotiate day to day, what do you have left?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess speaking of money, though, and related to royalty in many cases, fantasy movies, if they have a lot of money in the budget, generally don't care, or at least have a ceiling on how much I can care. So like I can watch the Lord of the Rings movies and really respect what's going on there, but I have a very hard time really loving those movies.
Huh. Yeah, I'm not the big fantasy guy either. I like Lord of the Rings just fine. But to my last point, I love specifically the books, the Game of Thrones books, The Song of Ice and Fire, because so much of it is about politics.
Yeah, see, I can't get on with it. I don't care.
Yeah.
But I say so I love a low-key fantasy, like All the Strangers from last year, a movie that has like a slight fantastical premise, but kind of more or less takes place in the real world. But the exception to my fantasy, if they have money, like I adore the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, at least those first three. So, you know, you do those with a bit of verve. I'm there.
Yeah, I'm obviously with you on, I've said before, with you on the Verbinski trilogy of Pirates movies.
And I think that's all I got. I got a couple other minor ones, but not nothing worth really diving into.
All right, yeah. Well, we'd love to know your turn-offs.
Absolutely.
We should have called them like movie icks, right?
I mean, we still can. You can still title the episode.
Yeah, things that give us the ick. All right, yeah.
People say don't yuck your yum. I say don't yum my yuck. Just let me hate these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that comic of the dude like pinching the other dude's like lips shut and saying shh, just let people hate things.
Yeah, I can get on board with that.
Yeah, I'm saying like, I'm a more positive person than I used to be, but also there is, I think, a cultural societal benefit to like talking about the things that we don't like. You know?
Oh, 100%.
It also reminds me of, I haven't watched Role Models in so long, but I love that movie. And one of the things that Paul Rudd, when he's sad after Elizabeth Banks has broken up with him, one of the things he laments about like missing with the relationship is we hate the same things.
It's a bonding experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I saw like a kind of like one of those life truism things of like people connect over the things they like, but bond over the things they hate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let us know what you hate. Let's see. You can find us at battleshipretention.com. You can email me at david@battleshipretention.com. Email Tyler at tyler@battleshipretention.com. Follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Davey Pretension. I'm on Letterboxd at David Backs. My other podcast is called The One Where I Met Your Mother, where I talk about Friends and How I Met Your Mother. And by the way, a lot of the stuff I talked about Sad Sack Men applies to Ross and Ted on Friends and How I Met Your Mother.
Sure.
Did you know, this is an aside. I can't remember if you were a How I Met Your Mother fan.
I only got up through like season 5 or 6. I can't remember where I kind of like just randomly fell off, but I really like the seasons.
So, the show is a three-camera sitcom. It has laughter, but it's not, there's no live audience, but it's also not like canned laughter. They would make the episodes and then screen them for people and record the laughs. So the laughs are actually genuine laughs that are happening, like, based on what we're seeing.
Yeah, love that.
So it's not, but it's because they had so many setups per episode, and so many different, like, sets that there's no practical way to do it all in front of, on one stage in front of an audience. Anyway, I just recently learned that. Anyway, so that's Word of the Woman I Met Your Mother. Tyler's on Twitter at More Lessons. Scott, where do you want people to find you?
Twitter and Blue Sky at Rail of Tomorrow, and BattleshipPretension.com. I posted a review recently of Gus Van Sant's To Die For, which has come out on Criterion 4K UHD. Very subtly good disc. You wouldn't expect to look at special features, but a lot of good stuff on there. And great, still a great movie. Been a while since I'd seen it. I was really happy to revisit it. I know I'll have reviews over the next couple of weeks, but I can't remember what. And I realized that we don't plug the Patreon for the main show, so go check out the Patreon. Oh,
that's a great... Okay. Yes. So, starting in April, and Scott, I know we talked about this. I'm not sure how much this is news to you or not.
Yeah, let's find out.
Tyler will be coming back to the Patreon once a month.
Yeah.
And a fun thing we've decided for patrons, you'll have to be a patron, to do this for the time being, like while he's still in a facility and everything, we're not going to go back to our regular sort of like top five movie years or whatever. Basically, patrons, you suggest topics for me and Tyler to do on the Patreon, and we will pick one and do one every month.
Love it.
So yeah, if you want to suggest topics for me and Tyler to talk about, you'll have to join at patreon.com/BattleshipPretension. So yeah, thanks for mentioning that, Scott.
Yeah, well, I thought of it because a podcast that I've been listening to for a long time, I'd never heard them mention their Patreon. I somehow found out about it like accidentally, and I was like, oh, I want to subscribe to that.
All right, well, thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.